From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and we deal with a wide range of mental health issues on the show every week. And we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask on this show is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you willing to keep putting off dealing with your own realities and the healing process involved in it, and find a sense of balance of body, mind, and spirit so that you can live more freely and more fully? Now, today being September 11th and the third anniversary of the attacks in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania on September 11th, 2001, my topic today is grief and loss in an age of terror. And I'll be introducing my guest in a few minutes. Her name is Vicki Lorenz, and she's a clinical social worker in Phoenix. But I wanted to start, actually, by acknowledging and dedicating today's show to the loss of three particular individuals, one which most of you listening may know, that on August 24th in Scottsdale, Arizona, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross passed away, and she was a Swiss-born psychiatrist who wrote the bestseller in 1969 called On Death and Dying, and her groundbreaking study on the end stages of life humanized the treatment of the terminally ill and helped to inspire the hospice movement in the United States. And she's the one that identified the five stages of death and grieving for us. And it's because of her, I believe, that we have come into a place in this country where death and dying are topics for discussion and conversation. And even TV shows like 6 Feet Under and Dead Like Me, two of my favorites, actually can address the issue of death and dying in a way that allows us all to maybe look inside at the same time. Now, I'm also dedicating today's show to the memory of a friend of mine, the Reverend Jeffrey Karen Dior, who was a performer, an AIDS activist who lived many years with HIV and AIDS, a philanthropist and a friend, and my condolences go out to his partner, Brett, his family, friends, and all of his fans out there. And even closer to home, I am sending out my condolences to my brother-in-law, Milton Grisham, who lost his sister, Joanne Grisham Heru, who on August 19th at age 46 died after many years of living with cancer. So my stepsister Joanna and her husband Milton and all their family, I'm sending out my prayers and thoughts to all of you. Now, this is grief that hits close to home, and grief, like with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, is more of a collective type of grieving. And if you've listened to my show over the years, if you go to tellthetruthfaster.com and go to the archives, you'll see over the past 3 years I've done a number of shows on the issues of death and dying and grieving and loss as it relates to illness, as it relates to terrorism. We cannot live through today without thinking in terms of the attacks on our country on September 11, 2001. But we also have to consider what's gone on in terms of the loss in Beslan, Russia, with the school that was commandeered by the Chechen rebels. We also have to take a look at how people all over this world are living in a state of terror and fear, whether it's the Palestinians that are constantly at the impact of living in fear and terror and the attacks on their land, and the Israelis who are living in terror and fear on the attacks of their land, whether it's the Iraqi people who have, to many, been invaded by the U.S. and are feeling the sense of maybe 10,000 losses of their own people. There are two sides to every coin, two sides to every story. And what all of this is doing is creating a world where everyone, no matter what your belief system, no matter what your political stance, all of us are grieving the loss of our innocence, our sense of safety in this world. And the terror is something that comes from without and also comes from within. And those are some of the issues we're addressing today. But there's a collective and historical context for this loss. And, you know, I got involved with doing a lot of grief work, you know, as a gay man and being a therapist for many years. All of a sudden this thing called AIDS came in. And it found me at the bedsides of many clients and colleagues and very close friends, doing my own grieving and helping their loved ones get through their grieving, and a whole community that was not being supported early on in our society. We had to turn to ourselves for the comfort and the support that was not coming from any other source at the time. So all of a sudden I found myself as a human being in a sense of multiple and constant loss and grief, and as a therapist dealing with grief and loss on a daily basis with clients and colleagues. And all of us can relate to loss and grief, whether it's, again, a collective societal cultural thing or whether it's a very personal thing. And my guest today is a clinical social worker in the Phoenix area named Vicki Lorenz, and she works at the Phoenix Indian Medical Center in the mental health department. She specializes in trauma and grief in the Native American community, and she herself is Native American, Kiowa and Wichita. And Vicki, I really want to thank you for taking time on your Saturday to be on the show and welcome you to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm very excited about today's show, that I have somebody that's worked for so long doing grief and trauma work in the Native American community. But I explained how I started specializing in this, but I'm always interested in how a therapist ends up focusing their practice in a particular area. And I know that one of your main specialties in working with the Native American community is trauma and grief. How did that come about for you?
Well, during graduate school, you know, they ask us, you know, what are you going to specialize in? You know, pick a subject, you know, and you go into that study, whether it's child abuse, alcoholism, you work with the geriatric population. And I just chose child abuse, so that was my graduate work. When I graduated, as soon as I graduated, I moved out here to Phoenix, and I began working. And all of a sudden, I started working with the elderly, the Native American elderly. I worked with them, and then they were dying. And then the families would come to me and, you know, oh, you know, my mother is gone now. And that's how it started. People started coming to me. We started talking about death and dying. And probably the last 5 years, it seems like my clinic is just working with trauma and grief. And that's how it started. And I don't know that I specialize in it. It's just something that came within me. It's just something that I seem to enjoy working with. I enjoy helping my clients. We talk. We support each other. So, and that's how I got into this work.
So it's kind of like I say, it's almost like a calling, one that's actually been put in your lap. I mean, There are certain people like myself who geriatrics is not the field that I'm comfortable and that I would be best at. And I knew that at a very early time in my career. And that there are other people where geriatrics is the most natural place in the world to be.
Right.
And it just seems like, you know, the working with geriatrics was a natural step into doing grief and loss.
Right.
But the issues of grief and loss that you deal with are not just within the loss of parents and geriatrics. You deal with a wider range of things, I would
imagine. Right. When I was specializing in my graduate school, it was child abuse and neglect. So when I came out to Phoenix, well, the position was working with the geriatric population and doing nursing home placements and medical social work. So that's what I started doing. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'm specializing in child abuse and neglect. Here I am working with the elderly and, you know, the grief and loss that they feel, taking them off the reservation, placing them in a nursing home in Phoenix, and then dealing with the family and dealing with the patient saying, you know, I'm away from home and I'm alone and my family can't come visit me like they want. I don't eat my native foods. No one can speak my language. And so I started dealing with that. And then as time went on, people started coming to me, lost a child from suicide, when they lost a family member from a motor vehicle accident, illness, diabetes was one of our big problems that we have here with the Native Americans. So I started dealing with just trauma and grief after that. It just with everybody. It was with the elderly. It was with, you know, losing parents. It was losing children through suicide, everything. So now I have a support group that we meet every week, and I have a wide range of people in my group who have lost partners or whatever, and we support each other.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about our losses and how we're coping with it, and that we do know that, you know, it's a journey, and life goes on. And I think that's the major point in my support group, is that the people in there tell each other, well, life does go on. Even though you feel like you can't go on, it does. Life does go on. You still got bills. You still got children. You still got other things that you have to take care of.
Or you need to create other things in order to do the healing.
Right.
I want to talk about, later in the show, I want to talk about the healing process itself. But I know when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross identified the five stages of the death experience, the first one that she mentioned had to do with denial.
Right.
Now, when I talked to my stepsister, you heard at the beginning of the show, I dedicated, you know, part of the show is dedicated to the loss of my brother-in-law's sister, Joanne Gershom Haru. What my stepsister Joanna told me was that Joanne, her sister-in-law, knew that she was sick and knew that she was dying, and yet chose for the last 6 months or 8 months not to tell anybody about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a level of denial that my sister, my stepsister Joanne and her husband Milton are both therapists, so there was a real sense of surprise about this, because Milton was very close to his sister, and she decided, and her husband decided, not to tell anyone in the family, no matter how close they were to them, that she actually only had a few months to live and that this disease had metastasized and was really taking her. And they chose not to talk about it, not to get the support, not to give their loved ones a chance to say goodbye or to do what their hearts move them in terms of support. What do you feel about this issue of denial, and how do you see it come at play in your work?
Well, doing medical social work, we would have patients up there who would choose not to tell family, and we would meet with them and talk to them and try to find out why they didn't feel like they needed to tell the family. And I think it was a big issue with denial. And, you know, well, I have diabetes, and I'm, you know, and the doctors may come in and tell me I'm dying, or, you know, my kidneys are failing and I'm on dialysis, and, you know, whatever. And they would say, well, you know, I don't want my family to know. I don't want any information out. And so we would meet with them and talk to them. And a lot of times they just didn't want to put any kind of pain or worry on their family. They just didn't want them to know, so that they could feel, when they came in the room, see the pity in their eyes and that feeling sorry for them. And so they would just not tell anybody.
In other words, they're trying to protect their loved ones from the pain, or they're trying to protect themselves from having to deal with the pain and suffering of their loved ones watching them go.
Right, right. And sometimes the denial was, well, you know, doctors tell me I'm dying, but no, I don't believe it. I don't believe it's that. You know, and just really strong denial, and would tell their family, well, you know, I don't believe this doctor. He's telling me this, and last time he told me this, I pulled through, so, you know, I'm not worried about it. And so just won't tell anybody, because if I tell anybody, then it's putting it out there that I am going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So the person would just not say, you know, I'm dying, because I know I'm not.
Right, so it's kind of a metaphysical type of thing. If I believe it, it will happen. If
right.
I say it, then I will create it.
Right. Right.
Even though there are certain times, because I know with this AIDS epidemic early on, as soon as somebody was told they were HIV positive, the next thing out of the doctor's mouth is, get your affairs in order, you got 6 months to live.
Oh, yeah.
And now, 20 years later, some of those very same people are still going strong. I mean, even my friend Jeff that passed away last week was definitely a very long-term survivor. He had been diagnosed probably 15 years ago with HIV and pulled through many near-death experiences. So it becomes kind of easy to start telling yourself, well, you know, just because they're saying so doesn't mean it's happening.
Right, right.
So what do you say to people who are trying to, you know, I have a belief system that when somebody is saying, well, I chose to lie to someone because I didn't want to upset one, that person, when the truth often is, I chose to lie to them because I didn't want to deal with the discomfort of their reaction.
Right.
So very often it's much more of a selfish and self-centered thing
Absolutely.
That I think an individual is acting out than a compassionate thing of allowing somebody to offer love and support in a time of struggle for their loved one. What are your thoughts on that?
We see, you know, and I see both sides. I see both sides of that. Sometimes it's selfishness and, I just don't want to tell anybody. I don't want to see. But then we also have others, you know, who are compassionate and say, you know, I don't want to upset my family. I don't want them to worry. I don't want them. So when I go in and if see my patient who is terminally ill, I will go in and we will talk about, you know, his immediate family, who is very close to him, who would, talking about maybe not, I wouldn't mention the word death, but I would say, you know, as you pass, who is close enough to you that would be feeling hurt and pain and guilt about not coming up here and visiting with you. And so I try to get the person, I don't force it, but I try to get the patient to contact that person to say, you know, well, you know, this is what's going on with me, so that there can be that closure there with that family member or that loved one. So I try to do that when I go in and see my patients.
And what about, you know, I want to take this onto a bigger stage for a minute, because today is the third anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks here in this country, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a worldwide issue going on here, no matter, like I said earlier, no matter what your belief system, perception of the politics of things, whether you're an Afghani or an Iraqi, you know, feeling your world being attacked and your life being attacked by foreigners coming in, whether you're a terrorist from that side attacking, you know, the U.S. and seeing us as these horrible people, you know, whether you're in Chechnya and a Chechen feeling like things are unfair, and yet I know that there are even a lot of political Chechens who are very much against the extremists who went into that school and did what they did. I mean, there's a craziness, there's an insanity that seems to be going on that almost seems out of control today that creates a sense of collective grieving, loss of innocence, loss of lives. People all over the world grieved over the loss of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. People all over the world have been grieving about the attacks in Beslan, Russia. And there are people all over the world grieving about the devastation going on in Iraq today.
Mm.
What's your thoughts and opinions on this collective type of grief? And how does it impact the clients you see or even yourself personally?
Well, like I said, I work at the Indian Hospital here in Phoenix, and so all my clients are Native American, and they come from the reservations, they come from the urban setting. So what I hear from my clients, you know, it like when 9/11 happened, some of my urban, the Natives that live in the urban areas came in, you know, they were upset and, you know, just feeling that sense of unsafe and worry and, you know, feeling sorry for the people that have lost their lives, their family. And so they would come in and we would try to console them and, you know, do some therapeutic work with them, trying to, you know, to calm them down. But But then I had the native people coming off the reservation who may not have electricity. They're just worried about getting transportation to and from the hospital. So that wasn't their concern. And yet, if I would bring it up, we would talk about that their concern was mostly, you know, let me get some food in my house. Let me get some basic needs. Let me take care of that. And, you know, I know the world goes on outside of me, but I live on a reservation. I need transportation. I'm sick. So I would see both sides of that.
Mm-hmm.
I really, and my patients would come in, and sometimes they wouldn't even mention the 9/11 or, you know, what's going on in Iraq and whatever. They just wouldn't mention it. And yet we have a number of our Native American men who are in the armed services. When they do come back, the Native people, they honor these men who have gone off to war. They have dances for them. They, you know, just make a big thing of this man coming back or woman coming back from the war and just honoring him and giving him things. It's a big thing. You know, we really honor those men and women who go over.
This is done in a more tribal or ritualistic way, in other words, historical rituals, or...
I would probably say tribal. It's more of a tribal, traditional thing. You know, warriors have always been held in high esteem for hundreds and hundreds of years. They have different societies within some of the tribes who say, you know, they have a warrior society. I mean, they're just held in high esteem. So now, and it's carried on till now, so that when we send our boys and girls over there, we think about what's going on over there, but yet we're also honoring our warriors who are going over there. We honor them and know that this is what we have to do to provide safety for us. You see, and it's hard to explain. It's hard to say, you know, well, I know they're going over there, they're killing people and things are going on and they're getting killed and whatever. We see that, but we honor them.
Mm-hmm. So they honor the troops without necessarily letting their beliefs about the war itself get in the way.
Yes, it doesn't get in the way. And yet they would feel, you know, they see the pictures, the ones on TV. They see those pictures. They see the loss and they see the children over there, you know, losing their parents and all that devastation. They see that. And yet, when their loved one comes back from the war, I mean, they'll have big dances. They will honor him. He will dance, and he will be given gifts. And it's just a big, big ceremony for this person when he comes back from the war.
How does the community or the individual tribes deal with the grief when somebody's coming back in a casket as opposed to coming back alive?
Now, when a person comes back, for example, you remember Lori Prastawa, the first Native American female that was killed in the war. And when she died, it was, she came back, of course, in a casket. The family grieved, the community grieved. It's also a big thing. You know, people, the family will have their visitors coming over. People will support them. They'll have a big, big funeral. They'll do the traditional funeral or not, but they honor them, and they'll have a flag draped over their coffin, and yet they'll also have Pendleton blankets. They'll also have shawls wrapped around the casket. So it's just as a warrior. It's a warrior.
Mm-hmm. So it's a warrior's funeral.
Yes.
Okay, and a very traditional tribal warrior's funeral.
Yes, most of the time. Now, there are, you know, most of the Native people, there are all levels of traditional Native people. The people in the urban setting who have lived here for years, born here, raised here, and have been away from their traditional teachings. Now, when their loved one comes back, they may just have a ceremony, you know, go to church and have the burial just like everybody else would have. But the more traditional Native people will have, that's when they have the Pendletons and the shawls and whatever, have the traditional burial.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all levels.
Vicki, we're going to take a short break here.
Okay.
And when we come back, I actually want to talk more about the healing process. I want to talk more about the healing process of grief and loss in the Native American community, but also get your thoughts and opinions as to those who are not part of the Native American community, what you see as the collective healing process that's going on from all the chaos in the world at this point.
Okay.
So we're going to take a short break here. This is Stuart Altshuler. You're listening to Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. Today's topic is grief and loss in an age of terror. My guest today is Vicki Lorenz, who's a clinical social worker in Phoenix. And if you've been listening and you've been hearing a lot of clicking, I want to apologize for that, and the technical problems have been cleared up, and hopefully the rest of the show it'll come through a lot clearer. Vicki, before we took the break, we were talking about the healing process, and you talked a lot about how the Native Americans, you know, do very traditional tribal memorials or whatever you want to call it, as well as those that may not be so traditional and tribal, but still, like everyone else, has their own rituals, whether it's Christian or Jewish or Muslim or whatever. So what's the importance in your mind of rituals as part of the healing process, whether it relates to the Native American or the general public or no matter what country you live in? What's your opinion about the importance of ritual in dealing with grief?
Well, over the past 5 or 6 years, what I've really noticed is if my client who is grieving do not have some kind of spiritual base, I see them having a very, very difficult time coping with their loss. The ones who come in who are use Christianity will, as long as they, you know, they can pray to God and know that God's with them, they do just fine. We go through the grief process. Now, my traditional Native Americans who come in and they use the traditional things, whatever they may be, they may, you know, could be burning sage, cedar. I see them, as long as they have that spiritual base, I see them coping with their loss. It's those who don't have that base, I see, who have a very difficult time with their loss. Very difficult.
In other words, people who don't have something greater than themselves, so to speak, a higher power or some kind of belief system that they can turn to for some kind of comfort. Rituals, I mean, you talked about burning sage. I know that there are, you know, fire ceremonies in Native American communities. Sweat lodges is a way of healing wounds for themselves. And we see fire very common to almost across the board to most religion and cultural belief system, whether it's lighting of candles, whether it's fire ceremony, burning sage or incense. What do you think this connection is to fire and smoke in terms of this process?
Well, as far as the Native Americans, we believe, you know, life. We think about earth. We use earth, what earth gives us, Mother Earth. And a lot of the traditional people, the Native people that we work with, I mean, if they have that spiritual base, they will use what Mother Earth gives them, whether it's fire, water, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they use. And I believe that's the way that I think that's why people use fire and smoking, that smoke and smelling that sage and cedar and they'll put it all in their house, and they'll smoke. And there's different words that there's different names of that ceremony or that practice. It's some people say smudging. Some people say, well, I'm going to smoke the house. And
mm-hmm.
and I And to me, it's comforting. I believe the people, when they smell that cedar, that sage, or whatever they choose to burn, once it gets in the house, it changes the feeling in the house. It it covers everything that you see in the house, and it's that smell, and it's almost like, well, you know, that's cleansing our house of the feeling of death or the feeling of loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think even, you know, Judaism has the lighting of the candles at every service and on Shabbat, and Christianity has, I mean, the Catholic Church, Episcopal churches, there's burning of incense, there's lighting of candles, and candles are lit in memory of or to, it's the same thing I experienced in the Native American ceremonies I've participated in, where the tobacco or something like it is thrown into the fire with your prayers, and the smoke carries the prayers up, you know, for the elders and for the, you know, spirits to hear and hopefully answer.
Well, what do you think? What do you think that why fire or smoke is, or, you know, lighting of the candles, why do you think, I mean, think about all the cultures that use some kind of fire or burning or something.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, I appreciate you interviewing me, because very few of my guests have had have turned it around, because I have very strong opinions on this. I've explored, you know, I've been on ashrams, I've been in Russian Orthodox monasteries, I've traveled the world, I've done shamanistic rituals with a shaman in Machu Picchu in Peru. I've done sweat lodges, and to me, the core of our essence, and in most cultures, fire is about the core source and energy of life. It's a comforting thing. If you think of people who love to sit around a campfire and just get lost in the flames, or I have a fireplace in my living room, and it's lit almost every night during the winter, and I can stare and go off into a whole healing journey just by staring into the flames. And I do believe that the flame, the heat, the passion, it's what kindles our life source and our energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a collective consciousness around this, which is why you see it in almost every single religion and cultural thing. You see fire as the source of most ceremonies and most healing and most prayers.
Right.
And, you know, I know that, you know, my first few sweat lodges that I've done were with an elder named Bearheart. And I was actually on a long fast. It turned into a 40-day fast that I was on, and it was like day number 21 when I did the first sweat lodge with Bearheart here in the L.A. area. He was visiting, and he named me in that lodge, which I know is an honor, and I know it's something that's not often done. And my native name is Bear Medicine, and I believe it's pronounced Nokushelikshwa, if I'm saying it correctly. But I was very moved by that, and I know that the sweat lodge itself, the fire, the heat, it's a healing environment.
Right.
It's a place that, in a sense, burns out the pain and allows one to elevate one's consciousness and almost, you know, actually leave your body for some people.
Right.
So the heat and the fire, even in the sweat lodge, is something that is used for healing and prayer and reconciliation.
The singing and the praying that goes on in the sweat lodges, the cleansing feeling. We have a sweat lodge on our hospital campus that we use for whether it's substance abuse patients who want to go in, or just people who feel like they want to go in to be cleansed. So we do use the sweat lodge. I wasn't raised using the sweat lodge, so I've not done that. There's other things that my family and what I've been taught to do.
Mm-hmm.
There are other ways that I use to cleanse and to try to heal myself.
What are some of those things that you
use? Just before I came out to Phoenix, my father passed away, and he was 72 or so. When I came out and I was working at the hospital, I didn't know what was going on with me. I just knew that when I was working with my patients, I would feel this sadness, and I just couldn't find out what was making me so sad? Was I empathizing with my patients? Was it their story? And come to find out, I mean, I burn sage, I burn cedar in my office, and I burn cedar in my home, and you know, prayed, and I would think about it. And come after I worked on this, I realized that I had not cleansed myself or reconciled with my father, the loss of my father.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I did that, and now, I mean, when I see my patients and I hear their stories and we pray, and some ask to burn cedar in my office while they're talking to me, and we'll do that, and we just, and we'll pray and we talk, and now I feel like, you know, well, I feel good. I know that my father passed on, and I know it was a journey, and it's a journey I'm going to take at some point. So it's kind of helped me deal with it.
Well, one of the things you're mentioning is a real issue for me is so many therapists are afraid to deal with the spiritual aspects of what their clients' lives and issues
mm-hmm.
are going through.
Yes.
And, you know, that they have this consciousness that we're supposed to only be dealing with the psychological and emotional aspects of what our clients are dealing with, and it means that you're ignoring a whole part of that holistic balance, as I
right.
said at the beginning, the body, mind, and spirit.
Right.
And I find that I know that within my own community here, AIDS has opened a lot of doctors as well as therapists into the need to deal with the spiritual, as we've all been dealing with illness and death on a major basis over the last 20 years because of HIV and AIDS. Even medical doctors have awakened to the importance of a more well-rounded practice in terms of body, mind, and spirit, and actually encourage their clients towards complementary therapies, towards prayer, towards meditation and breath work and things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been an interesting journey to see that happening.
Right, right. With the patients who come in, we talk about their loss and we let them cry. And that's one of the big issues with clients who lose their loved ones. Dealing with a loss, whether it's a divorce, whether it's a death, whether it could be anything, a move, you've moved, all the children have moved out of your home, they're adults now. Anything,
a loss of job.
Anything.
Mm-hmm.
When they come into the office, we sit and we'll talk, and a lot of times they'll just say, you know, well, I got to be strong. You know, I got my adult children I got to take care of. I got grandchildren. And, you know, I got to be strong. I don't want to cry. I don't want them to see me cry. To me, that is the biggest roadblock in their healing process
mm-hmm.
is that. It's that fear of crying, showing people that I'm hurting, showing people that I'm suffering.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is the biggest roadblock. And once we get past that, it seems that they start their healing process.
Right.
They start talking about it. But we got to get past that. And it's just the basic, just crying.
Well, for a lot of people, I believe it's either a cultural or family
mm-hmm.
issue where they've been taught that not to cry, not to be vulnerable, not to show your emotions. And like you, you know, I've worked with many clients that all of a sudden we start getting into issues that really the core of what's keeping them stuck at this point in their lives may have been the death of a parent 20 or 30 years ago that
yes.
they never grieved.
Yes.
And
weren't allowed to grieve.
Weren't allowed to.
Yes.
You know, especially children whose parents, it's like I always use this story when my grandmother died, my dad's father. It was the first time I ever saw him cry. But he didn't know I saw it because I was kind of peeking in a doorway. But also at my grandmother's funeral, my cousins, my brothers, and I were told to stay in the car at the cemetery. It was our grandmother and we were grieving. And I was 11 or 12 years old and old enough to know that I'd just experienced a profound loss, but wasn't invited into the family or tribal process.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think if parents are listening to this, it is your own fear usually that keeps you from allowing your children to grieve. They need to know that it's okay for them to feel sad and to see you feeling sad.
Right.
They need to know that it's okay for them to cry and to see you cry. And that you're giving them a tremendous gift by allowing that child their own grief.
Right. I tell my clients, the adult clients that I see, you know, children watch. They learn from your behaviors, your actions. When they see you crying for the loss that you suffered, they realize that it is okay. You may not even have to tell them. You just show them that I'm suffering, I'm crying. It's part of life. This is why I have tears, is to show my pain.
Some people also, I find, are just have a difficult time receiving compassion and support. And especially a parent, you know, because very often the innocence of that child knows that the thing to do is to go up and hold that parent.
Mm-hmm.
The parent feels like this isn't the way it's supposed to be, and they push the child away.
Right.
And it's that issue of whether it's the diagnosed individual who doesn't want to tell the family because they don't know how to receive the love and the appreciation. It's an important thing that people accept the expressions of condolences or of sharing the fear, of sharing the pain of the dying process. And it's not always easy because it's not something we're always used to doing.
Right. It's not something that people go out and just talk about and, you know, just, in conversations, I'm socializing with my friends and we talk. That's not something that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not something. And when my clients come in or even in my immediate family, when we've lost someone and we have not been allowed to grieve, and whatever that process is of grieving for that person, if we are not allowed to do that, what I see is anger.
Mm-hmm.
It turns to anger, and then they've got another roadblock up, and it's hard to get into them and to tell them that, yes, it's okay, it hurts. And so that I talk to my clients, and we talk about the anger, and we look at pictures, and I ask them, what have you done? What have you done to say goodbye to this person? And so then we try to get around that anger. And
how do you do that?
What we do is I go in there, I'll ask them to bring me pictures of their loved one, the person that they lost. And if they have something of that loved one, bring it in with them. Now, some of the Native people, the teachings are you get rid of everything of that loved one. You burn it, you bury it. I know one of my clients, her granddaughter committed suicide. She had to get all the granddaughter's personal belongings and bury it. And everything had to be there because you don't want to keep that sadness or that grieving with you. So that's what she did. So what I tell my clients who come in and are having a hard time, and, you know, they're angry, and they don't know why. I'm just angry. I don't want to talk about anything. I'm just angry. I ask them, bring in a picture. And if you have something of your loved one, bring it in. If not, bring a picture. Let me see it. Let's talk about it. And sometimes I use the empty chair technique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this loved one's here now. What could we have said to this person? What could we tell them about what's going on with us now? So sometimes our sessions are just that.
Right.
We just talk to that loved one. Or we write letters. Or sometimes we sit there and we just cry and think about them and remember what they smell like, their cologne, or they always smell like wood or cedar or sage, whatever. We think about those smells, the way they felt when I hugged them and whatever. So we do that for a couple sessions, and we talk to them with the empty chair or whatever.
Some good basic Gestalt techniques.
Yeah.
So you go from what Kubler-Ross called the stages, the denial, the anger is usually the second stage.
Right.
Bargaining is usually the next one. You know, if you let me live, then,
right,
you know, I'll join a convent or whatever.
Right. Right.
And then depression and then acceptance. You mentioned briefly a technique that I use a lot with people who like to write, whether it's a journal entry or a letter.
Uh-huh.
And usually I have them come in and I have them read the letter out loud, because it's one thing to do it hand to hand, you know, on paper or on the computer. But when they're actually saying the words out loud, it allows a deeper connection to the process.
Uh-huh.
So we both use very similar tools and techniques.
Right.
And we use them because they tend to work. So
they do.
You know, for those that are listening, if you feel you're blocked and haven't completed with somebody, sit down and write them a letter. It may be someone who's left 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and you think, oh, I'm done with that. But you'll be surprised at the deeper level of letting go and grieving that is there.
Right.
And the reality of it is, and I did a show a number of months back on depression and grief and the immune system, because holding on to these things affect us not just emotionally, but the blocked and repressed emotions affect us physically.
Right.
And cause us different health problems. Especially when there's a tremendous recurring loss, like the impact of 9/11 3 years ago, or the loss, you know, the multiple losses. When people are dealing with multiple losses, whether it's people that you knew, or like we say, it's in the news and it's something you're watching. We're watching on TV now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just something that is in a newspaper. We're seeing these things as they're happening.
Right.
It's important to stop your life for a little while and stay put and feel and think about what's going on inside you, so that it doesn't get piled on to the residue of so much else that's going on in our lives.
Right. And, you know, today versus 50, 60 years ago, when things were happening in the world, we would hear about them. And people would, by word of mouth or radio or whatever, we would hear it. And it just wasn't as traumatizing as today. We see it. We see it happening. We see death. We see devastation. And people and children, everybody, are getting traumatized by what they see on TV and just don't realize that how it affects them, how it affects the children when they see what's going on. I mean, we see the war in Iraq. We see what's going on, and we hear about it. And I guess I really don't think people realize that how traumatizing that could be.
Right. Well, I remember, you know, much younger days when Vietnam was going on. You know, I was 12 years old when Kennedy was assassinated, and I remember the entire week sitting in front of the TV watching over again the funeral and the killings and stuff like that. And that was a 12-year-old. And then Vietnam was the first war that was actually broadcast live on your news every night. And it does impact. And I think you're totally right to say that children today are being exposed to things as they happen and while they're happening. And we keep seeing the same images over and over again. And there's a little child in every adult, too, that's still being impacted by it. So,
yes.
Vicki, we only have a couple of minutes left. I usually like to leave that for my guests to, if there's anything else you want to say or add to anything we've been discussing or any points you want to bring home a little bit more, you know, now's the time because we just have a couple of minutes left here.
Okay. Well, I was going to say you introduced me at the first of the show, and I was just going to tell you that I'm half Kiowa and half Wichita Indian from Oklahoma. And I want to bring that up because I'm living in Phoenix, I am living with the Southwest Indians.
Mm-hmm.
So coming out here was just as anybody else coming into a different culture. I came out here, I am now being, after 12 years, being exposed to the way the Pimas do their burials, the way the Krishan or the river tribes, how they do their burial. They cremate. So I'm being exposed to that just as anybody else would come in and see that. So I would, to me, this is very interesting. So when I go home to Oklahoma and see my family, I tell them, this is, can you imagine, this is what the tribes do. This is what so-and-so does. And to me, it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, death is the same. I mean, it's
right. Grieving is still grieving.
It's still grieving, and it's a personal, very personal journey that we all take.
Well, Vicki, I want to thank you for being on the show today, your insights, and I really honor the dedication you have to the work that you're doing. And in closing today, I want to thank all my listeners. I know it's a difficult topic for a lot of people to listen to, but a very important one. And no matter what tribe you belong to, whether it's Native American or whatever tribe you belong to, and that term is used in a lot of contexts, that we're here to honor the differences in one another. We're here to honor instead of judge and criticizing the differences. If we learn to embrace those differences a lot more, this would be a more peaceful world and a world with a lot less terror involved. So I ask all of you to spend some time remembering 9/11 today, and find the places you need to heal your judgments of people's differences so that we can live in a more peaceful world. This is Stuart Altshuler, Tell the Truth Pastor on KXAM in Phoenix. praying for all the souls today. So we'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening.